So tonight is the fourth week of this series on leadership development in the church. We have two more after tonight. Next week is communication and conflict management. And the week after that is the mysterious world of church finances. Promises to be engaging for everyone. So tonight we are going back to the five characteristics of effective vestries, looking at numbers 3, 4, and 5. Mutual accountability and clarity of expectations, healthy rector, and good processes and structures. So we'll get into some of the nuts and bolts of vestry that often people are very curious about. So first of all, I want to talk about mutual accountability and clarity of expectations. This happens two ways, in unofficial ways and in official ways. In unofficial ways, we're comfortable with accountability to one another. In other words, you know, Ruth is going to make sure that the chili is there on time. Ruth, thanks for getting the chili here on time. Right. So she knows that she's responsible for that, and she's comfortable being held accountable for that. And she understands clearly what the expectations of her are and vice versa and so on. So part of this is just being comfortable being accountable to one another in a very informal way. Did you get this done? Did you take care of that? Sure, I did. Not a problem. Without defensiveness that can sometimes come with that kind of accountability. Very often, especially in small churches where you feel this is very informal, very relaxed, you know, where it's friends, to have that kind of, did you do this? Did you get this done? Feels a little bit more like work sometimes. But the more comfortable we can become with that kind of accountability, then the more effective we can be as a team together, trying to accomplish something together, right? So that's part of it, but also there it is helpful to have some structure in place for this kind of accountability and for clarity of expectations. Because the accountability doesn't really help you if you don't know what's expected of you. And if that's not clearly and mutually agreed upon, then there can be a lot of disagreement and misunderstanding and sometimes hurt feelings about what was supposed to happen. Did you're supposed to do, well, what was I supposed to do, and why was I supposed to do it this way, and so on. So these structures can help very much, especially in terms of mutual ministry review, something we're going to talk about. And certainly, the vestry, including the rector, have very specific expectations of them and their roles. And when that's clearly stated and clearly understood, mutually understood, then it helps the ministry of the vestry and the rector to work together. This is true on committees as well. So if you join the altar guild, you know what's expected of you when you are on the altar guild. And then it's clear, you know, if you've forgotten something or if you need to do something differently the next time when those expectations are clear. So one of the things that's an important concept for all this discussion is something called mutual ministry. Or you might hear it called the ministry of all the baptized, or there are a number of other buzzwords that have been used for this. But there's a handout that you should have picked up tonight, mutual ministry, and I want to refer you to it. I'm not going to stick with it real, real tightly, but I am going to make use of it a little bit in tonight's presentation. So the concept of mutual ministry is especially important because so much of our experience is in the secular world and in the business world. So mutual accountability and clarity of expectations has a certain dynamic in the business world. It's not entirely top-down, but certainly top-down is how it gets enforced and how it plays out. So that the CEO sets the vision for the company and tells the middle managers that this is what we're doing this year, and this is what we're focusing on, and this is what our goals are, and the middle managers help to implement that in the staff. Now, very often in business, there can be some communication going both ways to say, well, we think we can hit these goals or not. But the upper management at the top really is enforcing how this goes. And everybody understands this. They understand that, well, this is my job, and I have to pay attention to what my boss says I should be doing. And very often, most people are working in full-time employment, and so they're there in the business for a great deal of their week, and so they understand how this works. There's a lot of opportunity to understand how the company works and what the goals are and what is the right pursuit of those goals and what is getting off track. In a church, it's a little bit different, in part because Remember last week I said that, what, 68% of parishes in the Episcopal Church have average Sunday attendance of less than 100? So that means that probably 68% of parishes in the Episcopal Church have how many full-time employees? One, right? Who usually wears one of these funny collars, right? Everyone else is not as involved, although many people can be very much involved in the life of the church, but not necessarily engaged in the way that the priest might be, or maybe the part-time musician, and may not sort of understand the inner workings of how those jobs run. The other thing that's very important, and I'll show you with this diagram. This is how it was put to me once, and I thought it was very helpful. So pardon me for my artistic limitations here, but just imagine that this square and this triangle here represent a church. So this is the church. So in the church, I remember when we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, about the dynamics of Christian communities, the way Christian communities are formed and the way their personalities are transmitted. They're voluntary organizations. So the bricks and the foundation of this church and the bricks and the walls of the church really are the people in the congregation, people that make up that congregation. And the folks who are attracted to this kind of a congregation will come in. And so, therefore, the personality of that church is going to be perpetuated in that way. It's really a ministry of the congregation as a whole. And the clergy come in and go out. So the clergy, in many ways, are the most temporary parts of the system. And especially in a small church, because clergy tend not to stay for very, very long periods of time in smaller churches. But clergy come and go. And there are a lot of lay people that are very much aware of this. I remember someone who, you know, their family had been in the church for generations. And she said quite wisely, I've seen lots and lots of clergy come and go. Some of them stay a long time, some of them stay a short time. But the rest of the congregation stays, and it's the ministry of the congregation that is what is consistent, decade over decade. The clergy come and the clergy go. So when we talk about the ministry of the parish, the ministry of the whole congregation is important, absolutely vital. Now, the ministry of the clergy is important also, and the priest plays a vital role and can play a very influential role. But it's important to recognize that the entire congregation, both the vestry and the rest of the congregation, that's where the life of the church is, and that's where any change that goes on in a congregation is really going to gain its strength, not so much from that one person in the funny collar. The one person in the funny collar is important. The rest of the church is important, too. In the business world, when we think of a review, we have lots of full-time employees, and there's a clear structure of management and so on, and we have these reviews, and if it's done in a healthy way, it's also done in what in some business terms call 360-degree reviews. I don't know if that sounds familiar to any of you. So in many ways, the business world has adopted this. But in the church, when we started talking about reviews, a lot of people bring into the idea of reviewing performance with a kind of a secular mode. And when there's one employee gets reviewed. And so that priest then takes on himself or herself, more often than usual, all the unmet desires and anxieties of an entire congregation. And it's a little out of whack, right? Because if it's the ministry of the whole community, well, then is that one priest, is that one person really where everything rises and falls? The priest is very influential in a congregation, and so it's important to hold the priest accountable for his or her role. But it's also important to take a look at the vestry and the rest of the congregation and their role in ministry as well. So a mutual ministry review, then, is a review of the ministry of the whole congregation, and especially of the whole congregation's leadership, the vestry and the rector, together. And the other thing about a review that often happens is, or that sometimes happens, I think, is people are looking for blame if something doesn't work out. And so it's easy to sort of find a target for blame. But it's not about blame. It's about trying to be faithful and fruitful in ministry. And so if the focus is on faithfulness and fruitfulness in ministry, then it's got to be a collaborative program. It's got to be a collaborative process where the vestry and the rector and the wardens together are working on the ministry of the church and saying, how have we been faithful? How have we been fruitful in ministry? What is God calling you next? How does this work? Does that sound familiar to any of you? So some of you have heard this. So this then means how a review and how mutual accountability and clarity of expectations gets worked out in the parish changes maybe from how it's worked out in the business world. One of the things that often happens is that someone will say that they want the vestry to meet without the rector so that they can review the rector's performance. That's not mutual ministry review, because it's not reviewing the ministry that we're doing together. And it's really, it's like dynamite. It's really, it's a powder keg just waiting for a spark to do that. So don't review the rector without the rector present. Remember what I talked about last week about all those triangles and so on? That's a great way to just amplify those triangles enormously. Much better to have the rector there, and so you can have a frank discussion. Sometimes that can be difficult, but if you build a habit of mutual ministry review, then you're not having a review only when there's a problem. Doing it so that you can sustain the life of the church. So if there's a change that you want to have in the congregation, let's say we want more young people involved. It's not just a matter of hiring the youth director and then blaming the youth director for the failure or blaming the youth director for the success of whether or not you have more youth in the congregation, because it's a ministry of the whole congregation. One person cannot sustain an entire program, not for very long. It really has to be the ministry of a whole congregation. Sometimes, and the youth is a good example, sometimes if a youth minister is hired, great, now all our youth problems are solved. We'll let that one person take care of it. That means that you're giving yourself permission to ignore the youth. But if you see it as the ministry of the whole, then you know that you are going up to young people and inviting them into the life of the church, and you are appreciating young people for their ministry in the church, and you are supporting the program and inviting other adults that you know to get their youth involved in the youth program. You see what I mean? So it is important to see this as a ministry of the whole congregation. Change in a congregation is not going to happen because of one staff person, lay or ordained. Change in a congregation is going to happen when a large portion of the congregation starts to shift in that new direction. And that kind of shift doesn't really happen unless you have a lot of leadership. So that's why the vestry is so crucial to change and developments in the congregation. And continuing to pursue new things that God wants for you. How to get the congregation more involved in the review. I'll say a little bit more about how a mutual ministry review is conducted. Is that in practice, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of effort, and there's a lot of information to be. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the newly electrified recording of the fourth week of leadership development in the church. So we're talking about mutual ministry review and expectations in the canons and the bylaws of the church. So the bylaws are maintained by the local congregation. So you can decide whether you want to have 9 members of the vestry or 12 or 15 or 18 and how they'll be elected and what time of year the annual meeting is going to be and so on. That will change from parish to parish. But that's a good place for expectations. And you can write in expectations of the parish at large. You can write in expectations of how the rector and the expectations of vestry members. So if you want to know, well, are vestry members expected to be at all meetings, you can write that into the bylaws if you like. That's one way, and of course it's fairly durable. Changing bylaws takes amendment, and there's a process, and depending upon the bylaws, you may need to have the whole congregation vote on it. That varies from place to place. But that's one place in which you can say this is what's expected of this role. Steve?
But the civil courts to enter into the affairs of churches, they will defer to the procedures set
right
forth in the bylaws, whether it's a property dispute, a competency dispute, or some hierarchy within the church.
Right.
It's not just the Episcopal Church, the Catholic Church, too.
Yes, yes. Upon the polity of the church, there's can be a variety of disputes about that. But the bylaws do put down in print some way of saying this is how we make our decisions. So read your bylaws. Read your bylaws. Go back. If you're a member of the vestry, read the bylaws so you know what the rules are. And if they look funny to you and if they look different to you from what's in practice, that's not all that unusual, because very often bylaws are in a dusty drawer somewhere and you've sort of forgotten what the bylaws say. Pull them out. If they're inconsistent with the practice, maybe they need to be updated so that the current practice is reflected in the bylaws. But it's a way of putting on paper, this is what we've agreed to. Because if you wait until there's a disagreement and a conflict to iron this out, it's going to be much harder to iron out that conflict. If it's in the bylaws, then there at least can be a way to say, look, this is the way the bylaws have it, so this is what the practice we need to follow. If you feel like it's a bad idea, then we can talk about amending the bylaws. It's a way to engage that. But at least you have a default agreement for you. So in addition to bylaws, there are other documents that we can use to clarify what the expectations of people are. Start with what's called a letter of agreement, which is basically a contract with the rector most especially. But you can also have contracts with... Thanks, Eileen. That's Eileen Violini, our director of communications. She's the one who gets all the stuff up on the website. Thank you. The letter of agreement is like a contract. So it'll cover compensation. It'll cover a number of things about the duties and responsibilities of the rector and the responsibilities of the vestry toward the rector as well. It can be a good place where these responsibilities and expectations are laid out in print. Letters of agreement that you can get from the diocese if you're revising a letter of agreement or in a search for a new rector. Aside from that letter of agreement, you can have a position description as well, or a ministry description. That can be the description for the rector. And that document is a lot more fluid because a letter of agreement is something that's sort of firm, and to renegotiate it would be more of a serious thing to do. A position description might be you to focus on evangelism. Well, let's write that into to the ministry description that this year the focus is on evangelism and we're going to go after these particular goals. In that, you can set up some goals for the rector or goals for the vestry or goals for particular ministries. There was a project that Michael Brent worked on quite a bit, who's here with us. It was called Pathways Commission. At St. David's, we put together a binder for every ministry commission. And in that binder, there is a document that says what the mission of, in this case, it's the Pastoral Care Commission. This is the toolkit, right? So the Pastoral Care Commission, what their mission is, who their leadership is, what the different ministries are, and then how those ministries operate. And then each of those individual ministries will have a page of its own to say, this is how the Monday Morning Flowers works. This is how Stephen Ministry works. This is how Walking the Mourner's Path works. This is how Driving Angels works, and so on and so forth. So it's there to bring some clarity, in part so that the leader of Pastoral Care Ministries can now say, here you are. Congratulations. Now, to a toolkit that you ministry. And so it's a reference. It's not something that's sort of set in concrete. You can change it as the needs of the ministry change, but at least it gives you some focus. And as you're working on things, when someone says, well, why don't we start the zoo? Well, the zoo isn't really in our mission for the Pastoral Care Commission. You may want to try fellowship. They do things zoo-like from time to time. There's also another binder. At St. Mark's, we were much smaller. We could fit it all into one binder. At St. David's, we have 8 different binders, I think. But having these ministry descriptions can be helpful because if I want to ask, I'm going to pick on Warren now. See, Tony sat over there, so I won't pick on him. So if I want to ask Warren, would you get involved in the Altar Guild? Warren might say, but what's involved? Now I can give him a piece of paper and sit down with him and say, well, here's what's all involved in the Altar Guild. We're on teams of 3 people, and we serve, 2 months out of the year. So you'd be on the team for February and October, and you come an hour early and an hour late. And so you can review that with Warren, and then Warren knows what all's involved. And then he's better equipped to say yes or no, because he might say, I can never be there early because I've got this other commitment that goes on Sunday mornings, this Bible study that meets or something like that. So he might be equipped to say yes or no ahead of time. That way you don't jump into the middle of ministry and say, Warren, where were you? And Warren says, well, I didn't know I was supposed to be there.
Do you have the length of terms in there also?
Yes. We talked about that a week or two ago about term limits and so on. I think if you can put term limits in there, especially for the leadership, I think it's very, very helpful. Implementing them, especially if you haven't had term limits before, that's really tricky, especially when people become really possessive of the ministry that they've had for a long time. But it's really helpful to have a rotation of leadership It's helpful for the individual. It's helpful for other individuals that might have to take over when that person, it's what I call the hit by a bus rule. If I get hit by a bus today, who's going to be able to fill in my role in the parish tomorrow, since it's the ministry of the whole congregation?
Are you talking in the plans or in the bylaws?
Oh, in the plans. The bylaws, I tend to prefer shorter bylaws. So we did it at St. Mark's. We overhauled the bylaws and we fit them all on 3 pages. We're a little tight. We had to have room for signatures. But if they're really long and involved, then they're hard for everybody to consume. The toolkits that we have, these are 8 binders, just chock full. Nobody's on the vestry would be able to consume all of that. If you're on the pastoral care leadership team, then you'll be roughly familiar with those. And if you're the one doing Monday morning flowers, you know exactly what you're doing with Monday morning flowers, if you follow me. And each of those documents is fluid because the vestry ought not to be micromanaging those. But the vestry is loosely connected, and we'll talk about that in terms of structure, what's going on. The other thing that I would encourage you to do is, if you're setting up the mission of the discipleship commission, connect it to the mission of the parish. So if the mission of St. David's is, help me out here, St. David's folks, to know God in Jesus Christ and to make Christ known to others, then the mission of the discipleship commission should be to know God in Jesus Christ and to make Christ known to others by, oh dear, I do discipleship, I should know this off the top of my head, by providing programs and opportunities to grow in the knowledge and love of the Lord. So that's our mission. So knowledge and love. So it's, all right, so it's learning, book learning, but it's also experiential learning through spirituality and prayer and things like that. But there's this tie-in to the mission of the whole parish. That way, each different ministry has that connection to the vestry and to the central mission of the church. It's important, I think, also to note that in these documents so that you don't have orphans sort of doing their own thing. Connected. Yes, Hillary.
Another thing that's helpful is from time to time from the pulpit, that mission statement is actually expressed so that the congregation hears it.
Yes. Frank does a great job of that. Every announcement, you know, welcome to St. David's. Good to have you with you. Good to have you with us, especially those who are worshiping with us for the first time. St. David's is a church on a mission to know God in Jesus Christ and to make Christ known to others. So you hear that, and everyone gets it after a while. And when it comes up in a vestry meeting or a commission meeting or a committee meeting, then people realize, yes, that's the program. That's what we're doing here. Let's make sure that we're on track with that.
About 40 years experience, and working with the church in the number of ways that I do, in leadership, taking a leadership role, the thing that disturbs me constantly in trying to bring people together in church groups is that they deny they have it's any reflection on business. I mean, all that you have over there is job aids. And what you're talking about with this process and procedure of calling is hiring. When we called our priest, which was just recent, Michael just came in June, we began by polling the parish, the congregation.
Right.
And we took the top five or six topics important to the heart of the congregation and turned those into our primary questions for interview. And that's where this expectation started with us, because anyone who interviewed with us knew what our expectations were. But why do so many who work or volunteer within the church structure refuse to accept that it's business, that it's a business structure, and the church has to have business? And we are a business.
Well, some people business because their experience in business is really nasty. And they've had horrible experiences, and they've seen a lot of abuse of power. And they don't really want to think that of their church. But, of course, in church we can abuse power just at the best of them. Yeah, power, you know, it comes into play. So the more we can be mutually accountable and sort of understand that, we can maybe help some of those power dynamics. But I think part of it is the structure feels uncomfortable. especially in small churches, we want to feel like a family. And you don't have rules in a family. Sure you do. Sure you do. Of course you do. You know? And in a family, you argue about it like crazy, and people get mad and don't talk to them for years and years and years. So, I mean, it just gets played out on a larger scale in church. I find it helpful if it's written down, because then it's clear what you're being recruited to. So if you're recruiting somebody to stand for election on the vestry, I always recommend have the rector and the rector's warden sit down with a prospective candidate and say, this is what it means to be on the vestry at this church. And, you know, now that you know this, would you think about this and pray about this and decide whether or not you're willing to take on those responsibilities? And this happens before you agree to stand for election. So the from the floor are tricky because people aren't as familiar with the expectations and so on. And that's an important thing to do. I think it's okay to write it out. I think it doesn't mean that we don't trust one another. It helps to establish trust if we do it that way. Now, yes, it can become clunky. It can feel burdensome. It can be used as this sort of awkward tool of bureaucracy. You want to avoid that. Use it as a tool for ministry. Make sure that ministry is with the focus of what you're doing. Make sure ministry is at the focus of what you're doing. But this is a tool to help you in ministry. It's a tool to help you have clarity of expectations. And people will feel much, much more self-confident when they know what's expected of them, when they know what resources are available to help them accomplish what they've been called to do. But you're right. So in the interview process, that's where these expectations come, whether that's an interview for a rector, whether that's an interview for a secretary, whether that's an interview for a prospective vestry member or altar guild member or what have you. It can be in a page. It can be in a half a page with a couple of bullets. It can be fairly easy, but to have it written down, then it's clear, and then you might have forgotten about one or two of those bullets, but when it comes up and people are unclear, then you can go back to that piece of paper and say, well, this is what we wrote down a couple of years ago. Does this still make sense? At least it's a way of trying to get people on the same page. And families do that too. When they have a hard time with disagreements, families will write down, okay, this is our agreement.
I think also talking about power, I want to hear your thoughts on this. I feel like without a clear top-down structure, then people assume that there's not a clear power base. And then there's this constant backstage jockeying for who's going to absorb the power. Because I think as human beings, it's just not natural for us to come to consensus and to remember our mission and to think of something a little bit more up there than just a clear line of command. I think people sort of lose track of that. And then there's just, because we went through all those expectations too, and what I think jammed us up later were the things that weren't said. Mm-hmm. Because of the people backstage thinking like, oh, but we'll take care of this. We know how it's really going to go.
Well, there's two things that you bring up. One is the things that are unsaid, and I'll say more about that in a second. But the other is this power dynamic. There's lots of different kinds of power. Some of it is very soft power, social power, theological power, if you will, spiritual power in that way. But then there's also official lines of authority or decision making. And it's not that, you know, somebody is above somebody else, but that you pick somebody to make that decision. So you've said, so-and-so is the chair of buildings and grounds. You know, if you're upset about the ladder, talk to so-and-so. That's the person who makes those decisions. But if there is no agreement that there is somebody who is in charge of buildings and grounds, then there's a vacuum of decision-making, and people don't know what to do with that. It raises the level of anxiety in the room. Just remember when we talked about small groups, and I said, you know, you need to have a leader in a small group. That's part of it, is that when there's anxiety in the system and people don't really know how to deal with a problem or an issue, everybody's sort of looking around. And when that happens, somebody fills the vacuum. Sometimes it's filled in a healthy way, sometimes not so healthy. Well, then once a person has assumed that authority or assumed that power in the system, how do you undo that? On what basis? By whose authority do you undo the person's position in the system? So having some clarity to that is helpful. It doesn't mean that no one else has a voice. In the church, everyone does have a voice. But there are processes for making decisions that can help us all as a church to work more effectively together. And so that's why the vestry has certain authority, and the rector has certain authority, and Buildings and Grounds Committee has certain authority, and so forth. Does that start to answer some of the questions? Yeah, without clear lines of decision making, then people get mischievous. And when someone's voice is shut out, then they get mischievous. Because they make their voice heard, they just make it heard in nefarious ways. So you want to make sure, if somebody's disagreeing with you, you want to make sure you're hearing from that person. And legitimately, not just sort of daring them to challenge you, but really, you know, get it out on the table, let's be able to talk about this. So the other piece that you bring up is the unwritten and implicit expectations. So here's a way to get into this. I forget exactly who told me this, so I won't try to cite it, but it's not my idea. But it totally bears out to be true. So man and woman get married, husband and wife, and in the husband's family, where the husband grew up, the mother of the family always took the trash out. You know where I'm headed with this. In the wife's family, the father of the family always took the trash out. So the two of them get married, and what happens to the trash? Nobody takes the trash out, right? What happens between the two of them? Wow, I can't believe she's not taking the trash out, right? Oh, I can't believe he's not taking the trash out. Nobody told them in premarital counseling to talk about who's going to take the trash out. They talked about money. They talked about raising kids and so on. Nobody talked about the trash. It wasn't in any official document. It wasn't in the rubrics of the Book of Common Prayer. But they were expectations of each other, right? And they didn't know about it until it became an issue. And they weren't able to solve it until they talked about it. So here's the real-life example. From my own experience when I was at St. Mark's, we had started these welcome dinners, these hospitality dinners, so that folks who were new to the church or who had started to visit the church could come to people's homes and have a meal with some other newcomers and with some other members of the church, maybe the vestry. I was almost always there. And we had trouble recruiting lay people to host these dinners. And the rector's warden was really expecting that, hey, you know, these should be done in the rectory, and you should host these dinners. And we kind of talked around it for a while until he finally told me, look, you should be doing this. I mean, you're the priest. We're paying you. It's in the rectory. We own this house. It's part of our property. Shouldn't these things be done there? And so I had to talk with him and say, well, if you want to expect it of me, I understand that. But if you want it to be done at the rectory, then you have to negotiate that with my wife and with my family. And because you have to understand, too, and this is written in my letter of agreement, that the rectory is a private residence. And if it's to be used for parish functions, only at the invitation of the rector and the rector's household, not with the permission of, but at the invitation of the rector and the rector's household. And the rector's warden sort of, well, how are people going to find out about this? And I said, through conversations like this. I have to say, it was really valuable. Part of the value of it, too, was for him to say, look, I get it, and you need your private life and so on, but really, who am I such that I'm inviting this newcomer to church? They don't know me. They've never met me. Why would they come to my house for dinner? Isn't that kind of creepy? But you are the one voice they're hearing every week, because I was the only priest in the church. So you're the one who is preaching the sermon and giving the announcements and saying the prayers. You know, they know you, and it's kind of cool to be invited to the rectory. So it might be more of a successful program if you host at the rectory. And I said, well, I appreciate that. I hear where you're coming from. Let me talk to my wife first. And we'll see maybe what we can do. And we ended up by saying, okay, we'll host some, but we still want to make sure that the other members of the congregation are still involved, because that's pretty important, and I don't want to set an undoable precedent for the person who follows me that they have to host all these meals. And, you know, they were saying, well, look, we'll have somebody else cook the meals. And I told that to my wife. She said, no, in this kitchen, let me run the kitchen. But so we worked out an agreement. We wouldn't have known about these unwritten expectations. Well, actually, they were written, but he wouldn't have known about it if we hadn't had the conversation. You find out about these unwritten expectations when you have the conversation, when the issue comes up. You don't find out about them if you don't talk about them. But you can see how resentment can build, like with the trash. So talk about them. Talk about them when they come up. You have expectations that are written down. Sometimes these can stack up into a lot of documents that can be a lot to consume, but then there are also these unwritten expectations that it's important to talk about. Director, wardens, vestry together, and with the parish at large, so that they can understand some of, of how these things work. So a mutual ministry review to conduct them does take a lot of time and a lot of energy. I would say it's the sort of thing that you can do in a vestry retreat. When you're off for a whole day, then you can spend some time going through this. Especially if you haven't done it before, looking at the canons and the bylaws and the letters of agreement, position descriptions, and hashing through all that takes a lot of time. But the more frequently that you do it, the more people will be familiar with the materials and the easier it will be. Sometimes it's helpful to have an outside facilitator to come in and to facilitate the conversation, not to be able to take sides or to be an advocate, but to be an advocate for the conversation, to help people say what they need to say so that some of these unspoken expectations can be put out on the table, or so it can be brought out in ways that can be helpful and fruitful for the conversation. It needs to be done with everybody at the table, with the wardens and the rector and the vestry together, so that you're talking about what is our ministry together. Part of it is that the rector may have certain responsibilities that you need to review. Part of it is that the warden may have certain responsibilities. Part of it may be for the individual vestry members as well. So there are a couple of things you can work with, and this relates to, in some ways, human resources. There are two things you can look at. One is general expectations. This is sort of how we work together. How well are we fulfilling our expectations of one another? How are we doing our ministry as Christians? How effective are we? The other piece of it is specific goals. Remember we talked about strategic planning and those SMART goals? Specific, measurable, achievable, related to the mission, and time-based. So you can set goals for the rector, wardens, for particular ministries in the parish. You can set these goals. And then at the end of the year, when you have another review, you can sit down and say, how well did we do? Not so much as to find blame or sort of, and please, no formulas that relate to compensation. I don't think that's particularly helpful. But to ask these questions, and these are questions that I recommend here in this handout on page 3. Did we achieve our goal? Did the priest achieve his goal? Did the vestry achieve their goals? Did the wardens achieve their goals? What helped us to achieve them? If we didn't, what stood in the way? What hindered our achievement of these goals? What might help us to achieve the goals next year? And what sort of goals is God calling us to form for next year? Get a sense for that? It's all about being constructive. It's all about how can we be faithful and fruitful in ministry? And so what are the questions that we can ask? So, at St. Mark's, we were developing that binder I showed you and all these descriptions and so on. It was a huge project. And we didn't achieve our goals in getting them done in a certain time and so on. So we talked about, well, what stood in the way? And somebody finally said, this is just too big of a job. Can we split this up into smaller segments? And so we talked about how to do that and came up with a plan for the next year. And it was much more successful the following year so that the vestry didn't have to try to consume so much work at one time. So that was a very, very helpful conversation. Had we not had that conversation, we probably would have been beating our foreheads against the wall for the next year trying to do the same thing. But that conversation helped to form and shape where we were headed for the following year. How many of you all have had mutual ministry reviews in your congregation? And you're in the process of having. So, do you have an outside facilitator? But you have had an outside facilitator? Okay.
Very, very well done, very entertaining.
Good. Oh, wow. Cheap.
We had Jill Mathis.
Jill Mathis, who's the canon for deployment and transition ministry in the diocese. She's very helpful, so she can understand a lot of those things. I don't know if Carol Shepherd diocese. He did some work for us at St. Mark's. He's in New Hampshire now. Okay. Yes, he did some work. He's very skilled. Shepherd was very helpful as well. So you can get some facilitation to help you out with that. Okay. The next item on our list of effective vestries. Yes?
Quick question.
Yes.
It says the review is of everyone as individuals and a team. In a situation where you have one clergy, you've got a dozen vestry, it just seems like it's a little weighted.
It is. It is. Did you hear the question? So if you're reviewing the work of the vestry on the one hand and reviewing the work of the rector on the other hand, what's the dynamics like in the room when you have, all right, we're going to review you 12 people versus, okay, all 12 of us are going to review you one person. That's the dynamic that's dangerous, right? So it's tricky. Try to do it as much about mutual ministry as possible. And I think the wardens can really help to prepare for that meeting. So the wardens and the rector are going to sit down and probably anticipate some of what's going to come up. And that way you can get a sense for what the trouble spots might be. In some cases I've heard of people that have a committee that work on these reviews. So it's not the work of the whole vestry. There are pitfalls to that. And there are pros and cons. Pro would be that this committee probably is going to be more well-informed about what the expectations are. And maybe it's smaller and is better at confidentiality of dealing with some of the difficult stuff. So Methodist and Lutheran friends of mine have this pastor-parish relations or pastor-congregation relations team that is there to sort of help the pastor. But if it's not the whole vestry, then how can the vestry really be a part of assessing its own ministry?
My sense of this is that the conversation shouldn't take on the characteristics of an after-action review.
Yes.
As much as it's an in-progress work, so that we don't have drop-dead dates and say, well, it didn't happen, so it's not going to happen, so shame on you. Right? Then we just,
yeah.
You know, we didn't get it yet. Let's pick it up and see where we can go.
At the same time, I would say having those dates on there is helpful. The more you can develop a culture of, well, we missed it. What could have helped us to miss it or make it the next time? What stood in the way? Well, we didn't get this done in time. We didn't get that in time. Why was that difficult? Well, it's just too much for the committee to consume, and they're feeling a little bit burnt out. All right, well, next time let's leave a little bit more time in order to get that job done. It's a hard process to start, especially if you feel a little nervous and defensive about it, and it's easy to feel nervous and defensive, which may be why having a facilitator at hand would be good. And if you can do it in the midst of a retreat, in the midst of a lot of prayer, really reinforcing our role together as shared ministry together, that might help you. It's always a little bit uncomfortable, but it's I think it does come with the territory, I think. I did an adult forum once called "What Does Father Tom Do?" Because most people just sort of I remember hearing somebody say that. Oh, I thought he gets all the sermons off the internet, or doesn't the diocese send him the sermons to preach? I'm like, no, it takes a long time to prepare to preach. So it's helpful. At the same time, taking a microscope to what the priest does is not necessarily helpful, and depending upon the personality of the priest, could really be unwelcome. But the rector can say, this month I made this many hospital calls and I had this many funerals and I did, this number of premarital counseling and things like that. That can help. That can help because most people have no sense for how the priest spends her time or his time. The wardens are a good place to start with accountability for the rector, just because then you have one or maybe two people talking with one person as opposed to 15 people talking with one person. And there can be a little more give and take because they work with that person on a regular basis and have a little bit more rapport. I'm conscious of the time, so I'm going to move on. So the next element is a healthy rector that models and nurtures these traits among the vestry. You might say, well, we have a lousy rector, so we're stuck. Well, there's more to it. First of all, I would say in the search process, then you can look good, healthy traits. How does this person communicate? You can ask prospective rector how you deal with conflict. Didn't go so well. Tell me about an experience of conflict that you can ask, how can we get on your bad side? And then you can ask, how can we fix it? How can we get off of your bad side and onto your good side? I mean, there are questions that you can, and you can hear how the person answers and just try to get a sense for, is this person emotionally reactive? Is this person comfortable in her skin, his own skin? What's it like to interact with this person, especially around disagreements? Is this person a clear communicator? That can happen in the search process. Of course, once you've called an elected rector, then it's important to support the rector as well. Now, let me also say that on the list, a lot of times the rector becomes, as I say, the target for all the hopes, dreams, anxieties, stress, anger for an entire congregation. It's just incredible what happens. The rector is important. The rector is not the most important person in the parish. Be careful of putting too much weight on the rector. The rector is human, fallible, just like vestry members, just like people in the pews. So how can you help to keep the rector healthy? Well, what are some of the things you can do to help to keep the rector interpersonally healthy, emotionally healthy?
Make sure he takes
it
Sabbath time.
Sabbath time. It's in the Big Ten, folks. God thought it was that important. Put it in the Big Ten. Keep the Sabbath day. So the rector needs to have a day off. Needs to take vacation. Needs to take sabbatical time. If the rector's been there for a long time, make sure you've provided for sabbatical time. To do that ahead of time in your letter of agreement. I set that up ahead of time. Take a vacation. Take continuing education time. Do things to help support the rector so the rector is not just in the life of the church only.
I was going to say that we should not allow the rector to work 60 to 80 hours for a continuing period of time.
Yes. Yes.
It's not loving and it's bad stewardship.
That's correct. And because the rector does have an important part in the interpersonal system, if you have a worn out, burnt out, frustrated and angry rector, it's just wreak havoc on the rest of the congregation. Yeah, don't let him work that much. Don't let him work. And that's hard to do because the rector will make the rector's own choices, right? But that can be part of the accountability to say, did you take your day off this week? What'd you do on your day off? Well, I worked on my sermon. Okay. Next week, take your day off and go fishing. Hillary.
What the expectations of the minister is.
Yes.
But what theirs should be of the minister.
Right, right. The vestry is sort of the front line of running interference with the rector on a number of things. But like the conversation with the senior warden at St. Mark's, now when somebody else says, why isn't this at the rectory, why isn't this dinner at the rectory, then the senior warden can explain it or be proactive and explain that ahead of time. Yes, the vestry helps to communicate what the healthy expectations are for the rest of the parish. Now, of course, good clergy are told, and we don't always listen very well, but good clergy are told nobody is going to hold boundaries for you. You have to keep your own healthy boundaries because the parish will take as much of you as they can get. But that's one of the big jobs for the rector's warden is to tell the rector keep healthy boundaries or else you'll burn out or worse. Yeah.
So, can you give me some ideas on how we can keep them healthy, concerning what they have to do to keep their church alive?
Did you all hear that? That it's true in urban congregations. It's true in rural congregations. It's true in large suburban congregations as well. How many of you have seen from St. David's have seen Frank here on a Thursday? Frank talks about told me once. Frank is our rector here at St. David's. He told me about an illustration where you can take a rubber band and you can stretch it and you can stretch it and it kind of bounces back and it kind of bounces back. But at some point, you're going to stretch it and it'll snap. So now when I see Frank come in the office on a Thursday, I start shooting rubber bands at him. What are you doing here? What are you doing here? He's like, okay, I'm going home, I mean, one of the things you can do is remind a rector of that. But I tell you, a better way to do it is to say, Warren, would you help wash the dishes tonight so that Frank doesn't have to wash the dishes? That's one of the things that you can do. I mean, you can jump in there yourself, but you can also recruit people to get involved. Once a pattern is established where the rector is always washing the dishes and always flushing the boiler and always, you know, mopping the floors, that's difficult to undo. It really is. But the more the rector's warden is in the best position to say, you're running yourself ragged. This is a bad example. Everybody's going to expect you to do all this stuff. The next rector who comes along who doesn't want to flush the boiler every day, people are going to be upset because he's not flushing the boiler every day. So this is really unhealthy for us as a parish. Overachieving rectors will pay a little more attention to this is bad for the parish than this is bad for you. Explain to them how that's true. It's difficult in a small church. It's difficult in a small church, and especially if you have a rector really who has a lot personally and emotionally invested in a congregation, of course they're going to be there. A lot of lay people are there, long hours and so on.
Yeah, a lot of times so, the rector takes up slack that he or she really should.
Right, right. And the same thing is true with lay people. So before Sam turned 85, he really should have recruited somebody else to weed whack the headstones in the cemetery. Because at 85, he was still weed-whacking the headstones in the cemetery, doing an incredible job, no doubt. But while he's still healthy, recruit somebody to do it with you. Recruit somebody to do it with you that is maybe less than 85. So true for clergy, true for lay people. The more you can share the ministry, the healthier things are. My father is a retired priest in the Diocese of Ohio. He was ordained in 1955 and retired from full-time ministry in 1992. So as a preacher's kid, a PK, let me also speak on behalf of the rector's family or the associate's family. The comment about the rectory feeds into this well. Respect the privacy and the place of the rector's family as well. You might have a very active family from that clergy family. You might have a family that's not as active. Extroverted clergy spouse, you may have a very introverted clergy spouse. Okay, let them be lay people. Let them be lay members of the parish and bring their particular gifts to the life of the church that they bring. And don't expect them to have the gifts that the previous rector's family had.
It's not a twofer.
Yeah, it's not a twofer. You know, if you want to expect my wife to host all the meals, then you can sit down and write a contract with her, and I'm sure she'd be happy to negotiate that with you. It's appropriate to do that. And part of the reason for that, and some people might say, well, you know, wouldn't you want a partner in ministry? And sure, but if I'm, you know, clergy life is stressful, right? And if you're giving a lot to the ministry, when you come home, when I come home, I want to sit across the table and have dinner with my wife, not with the head of the Sunday school, whom I am having a conflict, you know, who's mad at me because I did thus and so at the Christmas pageant. I need my wife to be my wife at that moment and not to be another parishioner. Which is not to say that the family shouldn't be involved, except for this. Clergy family should not sit on the vestry. A family of staff should not sit on the vestry. You're really asking for mischief if you do that. Really kind of tricky. Otherwise, absolutely. Take part in the life of the church as God has called you. Share your gifts as God has called you. But the clergy family is an important part of keeping the clergy healthy. And the same goes true for your lay leaders as well. That pay attention to when you're recruiting somebody for the fifth committee meeting that week, realize that, you know, they have a family life that they need to pay attention to, and that's part of their call of God on them. And so when they say, I'm sorry, I can't do that because I promised I'd go to my son's ball game, that's okay. That's okay. Recruit somebody else. God has not equipped that person to do that ministry at that moment because God's got another call for them. So good to keep everybody healthy, but the rector too. And, of course, in mutual ministry review, you can address some of these issues that you might have with the rector. So the last piece of this is processes and structures that nurture unity and positive interactions, productive meetings. So this gets into some of the nuts and bolts. Let's talk about this. We talked about canons and bylaws, so that gives you some of the nuts and bolts for the structure of decision-making. Part of what you can specify in the bylaws is the recruitment of new vestry members and how elections are run and when they're held. Now, there are a couple ways that vestries do elections and recruitment of new vestry members. One is by demographics. and there could be any of a number of demographics. It could be age, it could be sex, it could be race, a number of things. So demographics might be considered. Another is by skills. We need an accountant, we need a contractor, we need a painter, we need this and that skill. And the third way is what I would call traits, interpersonal traits. There's a priest who used to be in this diocese who said, I have two criteria for serving on the vestry. One is spiritually and emotionally mature, and two is no personal agenda. If you got those two things, you could be anybody and have whatever skill, and I don't care. You can sit on the vestry. And as you might guess from what I've talked about in the last few weeks, I agree with him. Interpersonal traits are the most important thing to look for in a vestry member. You might be ready to have a building expansion and say, hey, Joe's an architect, why don't we have Joe in the vestry? But if Joe's a really cranky, kind of narrow-minded architect, put Joe on the building committee, not on the vestry, because you're going to have to listen to Joe on every aspect of business for 3 years, if Joe sits on the vestry for 3 years. Nothing against architects, but just keep in mind what it's like to work with each other as a vestry, as a team. Those things are important. In terms of demographics, sometimes the demographic considerations can be made once you have a pool of people from which to draw. So you may say, okay, here are 10 people that we're considering asking to run for vestry. Wow. You know, there are 8 women and 2 men. And there are already 10 women and 2 men on the vestry. Maybe we can do something to recruit some more men for the vestry to help balance this out. I don't know of anybody that really has any kind of strict quotas about that, but I think it's certainly helpful to have some diversity on the vestry, especially if it reflects the diversity found within the congregation. But that can often be done once you've got a pool of people that you feel would have the traits and the gifts to do well in this kind of ministry. So there are a number of different nominations. Some churches will have nominating committees that will come up with a slate of candidates for the election. The nominating committee sometimes is made up of outgoing vestry members. Sometimes that's okay. Sometimes it creates a revolving door, so that in some cases the spouses of the outgoing members are the ones who are nominated and elected in. And so you have the same 3 families just kind of recycling personnel. In terms of keeping people healthy, that's another really good rule. No spouse or family member of an existing vestry member ought to sit on the vestry, you know, which can be really hard, especially in a small church. But let me tell you, you'll burn out that couple. Same dynamic as I was talking about with me and my wife, if she's the head of the Sunday school, right? You have that same thing. If those 2 people are involved in vestry, it just burns out a couple. So one family member at a time, if you can. So a nominating committee could have outgoing vestry members and some people from the parish at large. Maybe they've served on the vestry, maybe they haven't. Maybe the wardens are involved. In some cases, the nominations are really done by the vestry as a whole. Maybe you have a small enough vestry and you have the time to be able to do this. At St. Mark's, we were a small vestry or a small church, so it was easy to put those names together, to come up with a list of names and try to find some way to prioritize them. Then with a list of names that are prioritized, then the rector and the senior warden could go and sit down with each person and say, this is what's expected of vestry service. What do you think? Would you be interested in this? Can you fulfill these expectations? Would you pray about it and then come back and have a sense of whether or not somebody's willing to stand for election under those terms? We talked a few weeks ago about contested elections or uncontested elections, and I think we had a show of hands. How many have uncontested elections? 3 spots, 3 people running, right? How many people have contested elections? At St. David's, there's a process. I think maybe 5 members of the congregation have to sign a kind of like a petition for. So if Catsey's going to be nominated to the vestry, Catsey gets 5 people to sign a name, and that person's name gets put in. Ask the person whether they're willing to sit on the vestry first before you nominate the person. And if there's some process by which you can let them know what's expected of them ahead of time, that's really, really important. There are pros and cons. The pro to having three people nominated for three spots is that you can find some balance there, so you're not electing three accountants. Maybe you need an accountant, but maybe you only need one. Or a balance of traits, or a balance of representatives of the parish, so that maybe, you know, instead of three choir members, you're electing one choir member and one person who deals with youth and one person who deals with pastoral care or something like that. So if you're forming a slate like that, that can be helpful. The disadvantage, of course, is that the rest of the parish feels a little bit out of the loop. Like, well, what are we here to do? The names are already set. If the election is competitive, then people have a little bit more of a say. They might have a little bit more of an interest in what's expected of a vestry member. They might read the bios of who these people are who are running. Just if there are three spots, don't run four people. Because then you have one person who has lost. If there are three spots, run at least five people. So it's not just on one person. And hopefully you have five people running who are really all pretty well qualified to sit on the vestry. In that case, the two people who didn't get elected, you can recruit into some other kind of leadership that's not vestry leadership. You can make them a chair of a commission. You can make them run a particular kind of ministry. Because you know that now this person has some visibility in the parish, and this person also knows we care about you, we have a place for you in leadership and ministry here, and it can keep them connected so that they don't sort of feel a little bit left out and drop back into the periphery. Does that make sense? I think it's can be very helpful there. Yes?
Do you suggest a process for filling vacancies midterm?
Yes, if it's written out how you fill vacancies, then that's helpful, because oftentimes vacancies will come up. So then what do? Does the vestry elect, or do you have to have another congregational meeting? If you have it written in the bylaws, then it's clear how it's done. Term limits, have some clarity to the term limits. Read the bylaws and then start to figure out, okay, let's say we had somebody drop out, and then we fill the vacancy with an appointment, will they still be eligible to run? And will they still be eligible to run for two terms, thus they could actually be there for almost three terms? Try to work out the permutations and see if the way you've written the vestry, the parish bylaws, help to make sense of that.
We have that. What we don't have is a definitive way to fill a vacancy midterm. And over the years, it's been that fourth person who did
it. Oh, I see.
Has been put in, and that's been okay and not okay. And then other times we go out and just
clarify to the bylaws. That's the sort of thing that it's important to have in the bylaws.
Is there a recommended method, what I'm asking you?
Is there a recommended method? I don't know. It's a good question. I think what I've seen most commonly is that the vestry has the authority to fill a vacancy. So that maybe the wardens will come and say, we think that Warren ought to fill this vacancy. Do you all approve? And the whole vestry says yes. Or we say, well, there are these two people, there's Warren and Bob, who do we want to elect? And then the vestry makes an election between the two of you. But if it's written out, then that's clear. I think having the vestry do it rather than the whole parish just is expedient. Now, some people might say, well, it's kind of a good old boys network. So watch that. If that becomes a problematic dynamic in the parish, change the bylaws. Make the parish do it. That way there's a greater sense of transparency in how the vestry is doing its work. But it's usually, especially in a small congregation, it's just usually much more expedient for the vestry to recruit somebody on. And that's also a way of cultivating cultivating leadership from outside the vestry. So I'm looking at the time. We have 15 minutes. Speed through the rest of this. Okay, I'll skip that part. We talked a little bit before. All right, I'll show you in brief, and then I'll leave this up here if you want to take a look at this afterward. There are a number of different ways to structure ministries and commissions. I think I took you last time through the way St. David's has it structured. We have it structured in these different commissions. This was an example from Bishop Grew, who was the bishop of the Diocese of Ohio at one point. So he didn't have evangelism in there. He said, evangelism is the whole thing. I might like to have a committee just for evangelism. At St. Mark's, we had one called Evangelism and Parish Life, so that this was kind of squarely in our vision, our field of vision, because that was an important goal for us. The structure that we had at St. Mark's. And we started with worship and pastoral care together and eventually split them into two. Bishop Dyer talks about these seven signs of a of vitality in a congregation. He starts with prayer, so there's a lot of focus on the life of prayer in a congregation. Anyhow, so this is up there for you if you're curious. So there are lots of different models for ministry, and you find what works well for you. Sometimes the way you structure it, no, let me say that a little bit more strongly. The way you structure ministry really should reflect your mission priorities. So if growing the church is a priority, one of those bubbles better say evangelism. If it just says hospitality, you welcome the people who are showing up to your door already. If it says evangelism, that may mean how do you go outside of your door and contact people to welcome them into the church. If money is the first thing you deal with and the most important, then, you know, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And you can, Bishop Dyer said, talk about stewardship and the budget at the end of the meeting agenda. Because if it starts at the beginning of the agenda, sometimes you can get lost in the details of it. So how you structure your agenda can affect your priorities as well. Yes? Yes, that's Bishop Dyer and I thought the same thing. So stewardship and vocation would include buildings and grounds and finance. So that if they can see, if buildings and grounds and finance and pledging and so on can see what they're doing as a ministry of stewardship, as a care of the resources that God has given the congregation to carry out ministry, it frames it in a slightly different frame of mind. I think that can be helpful. Maybe it's just semantics, but I think it can be helpful semantics. Otherwise, there's a sense of disconnect of, oh, well, there's that spiritual thing over here. You know, we're really worried about just the buildings and grounds. Well, it's still stewardship. Stewardship for ministry. Yes?
I think this is for next week, but it's in this context. It seems that maybe a key for small and struggling parishes is going to be to redefine mission and see what do we really, really need to do, not what are we used to doing. But I don't know where you start on that because everything's a sacred cow.
Yeah.
Everything.
Everything's a sacred cow. I think there are lots of different ways you do it. You can start on a project like that with a parish retreat. You can have a number of different activities that engage people in thinking about the history of the church and then thinking about the church going forward. There's a process called appreciative inquiry. That's a way of sort of building on the strengths of a church's history. But also, then you have in front of you, oh, that was our history, but things are a little different now. So what's God called us to now? That process of discernment of the way ahead often happens in a transition, in an interim, in a rector search, where there's that self-study. But you can do that even when the rector's in place. It can be very, very helpful to ask the question again, fresh, what has God called us to? And that process is a slow process of discernment, but it can be very helpful. Let me say a little bit about the calendar for meetings and the meeting structure. So often the way vestries meet make it really difficult on the life of the vestry. So let's say your vestry meetings start at 8:30 in the evening, and they go for 2 hours, and then they get extended another half an hour and another half an hour. It's just deadly. You're exhausted at the end of the day. You've already put in a full day of work if it's on a Tuesday. There are different ways of setting up the calendar for meetings. You could have dinner. I'm all about food, right? All about having dinner before a meeting. So you could start the meeting much earlier and have a dinner together. There's a St. Albans in Washington, D.C. would have a dinner together before they start the vestry meeting. So you can start it earlier in the day. People come right from work, have dinner, then they have the vestry meeting. Or feel pretty refreshed. They've had a chance to talk with each other, catch up, talk about what's going on in their lives. And they're more connected to each other as a community before they start the work of the vestry, so to speak. Of course, all that community building is part of the work of the vestry. One church, and I adopted this at St. Mark's as well, St. Margaret's Woodbridge in Virginia, would have vestry meetings on Saturday mornings at 8 o'clock. That'll get it done. You're not going to drag on for 3 hours there, right? Because nobody's going to eat up your Saturday. For some people, 8 o'clock is a bit early. But we actually, at some point, moved it down to 7:30. Now, there was one person who said, no more than 7:30, please. I just am not an early riser. But it was so helpful, so productive. A lot of people had so much going on in their lives. But starting early in the morning, we got our work done in 2 hours. You know, we fitted into that time. And we were fresh for the most part. A little coffee, some donuts. We were fresh and much more energized than at the end of the day. Some people have vestry meetings on Sunday after church. Oh, I'm glad to hear moans from you all, because my goodness, especially for the clergy or for other people who are really active, involved in ministry, acolyte chairs and altar guild folks, that's a bit exhausting. It makes for a really long Sunday. For some people, it works. You know, figure out what works for your congregation, but think creatively. Don't be afraid to think creatively about what works best. Try to get everybody together at the meetings at all times, because it can so disrupt the continuity of the vestry. You only meet about 11, 12 times a year. And if you're meeting 2 hours per meeting, that's about 24 hours a year that you're actually working together, aside from a vestry retreat. That's a small amount of time when you think about it in the scale of things. So I'm trying to make sure everybody's there. Most vestries meet monthly. How often do you meet monthly? Anybody meet any differently from monthly? Ran across one church that met twice a month. I thought that
We're
was a bit much.
About quarterly.
Quarterly, really?
We're talking about.
For a long length of time, or for just 2 hours?
That's. Well, I mean, we're talking about the whole model.
The whole model, yeah. Quarterly sounds a little infrequent to me, but it depends upon the life of the church. Maybe the vestry really is about some large picture ideas, and the ministry structure outside the vestry is extraordinarily strong and well put together and well integrated and doesn't need so much the connective tissue of the vestry to hold it together. One of the things about meetings that's so very important is preparing for the meeting in advance. It's just agonizing to sit in a meeting and watch people pick up a piece of paper that they've sent to you ahead of time and read the entire piece of paper for the next 5 or 10 minutes, or maybe 2 or 3 pages. I really strongly urge people, send reports out ahead of time and read them. Make sure that they are read ahead of time. That way, what you are doing in the vestry meeting is you are responding to the report. So here is the report from the Discipleship Commission, and here is the question, can we have $2,000 for this program that we're going to run in September? Then the vestry, having read the report, can ask questions, can talk about it, the pros and cons, and decide, are we going to give $2,000 or $5,000 or $1,000, or do we want to do it in the spring instead of in the fall? You follow me? That way your time is not taken up just by listening to reports. You can get reports written, email. We talked a little bit about, you know, what if people don't have email. Find ways to get those reports out ahead of time. Get things on the agenda. So in the middle of the meeting is not the time to start the 45-minute discussion about something that nobody knew anything about. Get it on the agenda ahead of time. Some vestries will have agenda committees, but by and large, I would say the people who set the agenda would consist of the rector and the wardens. So the rector and the wardens going on. The rector and the wardens should be meeting outside of the vestry meetings on a regular basis to talk about the life of the church and the things that are going on and preparing for the vestry meeting upcoming and saying, okay, here's the agenda that we have. And then you send that out saying, here's the agenda, here are the reports. If anybody has any pressing business, let us know, and we'll see if we can get it in the agenda. Now, there is some gatekeeping in that, and you may say, well, I asked you to put that on the agenda, and it never came up. Well, that may be a case where if that happens once or twice in a row, then you may say, in the meeting, next meeting, I want to talk about this and put it on the agenda. Can we all decide to put this on the agenda? And then it gets put on the agenda. So there is some accountability there for the rector and the wardens to make sure the stuff gets on the agenda. But have it prepared ahead of time, especially for the rector and the wardens, so they kind of know what's coming. Surprises are not helpful for the people who are heavily invested in the ministry of the church. So get that out ahead of time. Yeah?
I sort of like what you did here, what you're saying. You have three classes of information, three classes of things for the vestry. The information for the vestry and the information seeking the vestry advice, and the information requiring action by the vestry. The only thing is, I think I'd like to reverse the order. So that at the end of the meeting, that's when everybody's all tired, they just hang around for some information, but they've taken the action and they've gotten all that out of the way.
Right, have the action items up front,
yeah.
And then have more open discussion left for later. There's a couple of different ways of structuring it, and a lot of the strategy depends upon your own experience in that vestry. The reason that I talked about those three particular things is sometimes there's confusion about what we're doing. Are we deciding what hymns we're going to sing and what hymns we're not going to sing? No, but we're giving advice to the rector about that decision, if you follow me. so that there's some clarity of, are we just receiving a report, or is there some action that we have to discuss and take? Are we discussing something and passing on some advice for the committee who's going to work on this, or are we going to make a decision about this? Is this a decision the vestry has to make? So if you understand what we're doing in this conversation, that's helpful ahead of time. The way you structure it could be a lot of different ways. I mean, at St. Mark's, we were doing a lot of development, leadership development, and so on. So the first hour would be a lot of task-oriented things. Let's make this decision, this decision, this decision, and then we'll spend the second hour talking about church growth or about this particular ministry in the life of the church. We used to, at St. David's, we used to hear reports from each of these commissions. And so each commission would get maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And what we've done this year, this program year, is these reports are still sent out ahead of time, and maybe outreach has a crucial issue that come up that they may want to say something about, or a decision gets put on the agenda. But really, this month, we're hearing from the Fellowship Commission and the Discipleship Commission at length for, like, you know, 20 minutes each or half an hour each. So we're hearing a little bit more in-depth about that particular ministry, and I think it's worked out pretty well. Yeah, very helpful. So you can structure the agenda in ways that are helpful and productive. So if it's task-oriented, yes, you can stick it up front in the meeting, and that way rattle through it pretty quickly. The best you can do, your best to stay with the agenda and not let it creep out too far, which I'm watching my time, so I don't let it creep out too much. We talked a little bit about cultivating the vestry as a small Christian community. And so when you prepare the agenda, also think about Bible study. Also think about prayer. And think about that just in terms of the dynamics of what's going on in the life of the vestry at that moment when you may need to pray. Here again, it's not, you know, God, great to have you now. We work on our business and we'll welcome you in. If you're doing this in the presence of God, do things that can help to cultivate that. Some of that can be done in the reporting. After you hear the report from the Discipleship Commission, maybe you can have a moment of prayer to give thanks to God for what God has accomplished through the ministry of that commission. It's most helpful when that reflection really connects to the life of the vestry and is not just about any particular spiritual concept. Yeah. Sometimes a vestry retreat, to think about strategic life of the vestry, vestry retreats are very helpful. You could have them at least once a year. Sometimes vestries will have them twice a year. Those retreats can be for mutual ministry review, for talking about the business of the vestry, the direction of the church, or they may just be about developing our spiritual lives together. And it may be that 10-minute reflection may be really the bulk of what the vestry does in that retreat. It may be important to do. So you can structure those in different ways. Strategic planning is important. I talked a little bit about that a few weeks ago. Leadership development is important to talk about as well. Who is active in the life of the church that we might help to recruit to raise up for the vestry? And how are we doing as a vestry together? It's good to have outside speakers come in sometimes. A few of you have mentioned that for vestry retreats. To have somebody come in from the outside to be able to talk about things in a fresh way, in a fresh light, can be very helpful.
Go back to the canons for a minute.
Sure. No. It's more likely to be addressed in the National Church Canons, and then more specifically than that, in this book called The Manual of Business Methods in Church Affairs. There's a general recommendation that it's the loose offering from one Sunday a month, but there are a number of different ways you can fund discretionary funds. The important thing to pay attention to is the accounting and the use of discretionary funds. A rector is not to use the discretionary funds for, you know, to send the rector's son to college, as much as I might like to do that. It is for folks in need. It is not for the rector. There's all kinds of tax implications as well as ethics implications in the church for the priest. Accounting for that, if it's a discretionary fund, it needs to be discreet. So you have to find some way to have accountability and discretion at the same time. And there are a few different strategies, but you have to. The manual will help to address that. So, well, we're out of time, but I invite you to stick around if you have some more questions, and we can talk about it. But go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So next week we'll talk a little bit about communication. We'll talk about some of those group norms for those meetings, and we'll talk a little bit about conflict management. It's a big topic, but we'll start to address it.